Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tonight I'd like to talk about the power of the Buddha's teaching and the path of practice to transform our suffering into happiness, and particularly how we work with the mind in meditation to accomplish this. And this comes out of a number of questions I've been asked recently by people who are trying to deal with obsessive thoughts, with unhappy situations in their life, and who are applying the Buddha's teachings, sometimes finding success and sometimes feeling very frustrated because they're not getting the result that they want as quickly as they'd like to. And so we really need to understand the theory of the mind which lies behind the instructions that we need to follow, and how what we do in our meditation is just representative of what we have to do in the whole of our life, and that we can't expect to get a result in our meditation if we don't understand the impact that the way we live our life has on the mind. But also, when we start to understand the way the mind operates, we see how it operates under the same factors as that are playing out in our daily life. And to give an overview of this, I'd like to mention the teaching which the Buddha gave as a summary of his teaching of this path of practice. And this is something that is very familiar for those of you who've been practicing for a while. For those of you who are fairly new to Buddhism, you won't probably be familiar with this. But it seems such a simple statement that we can overlook how valid it is and how important it is that we use it in our practice, both in our meditation and also in our daily life. And the summary which the Buddha gave when he was asked what was his teaching about, he said that the teaching of all the Buddhas is the same, and that is to refrain from doing what is evil, what is harmful, what is unwholesome, to cultivate what is good, and to purify the mind. Now, very often when we are in difficulties and we have an unhappy situation, we want to jump to the purification of the mind so we can be happy, without realizing that the purification of the mind arises out of refraining from doing what is unskillful, what is harmful, and from actively cultivating what is wholesome, what is helpful, what is skillful. We somehow think that the purification of the mind is something that we can do almost in abstract, removed from the way that we live our life. Whereas the purification of the mind, which takes place in meditation, also takes place in our daily life as a result of what we're actually doing with our mind, with our speech, with our bodily actions throughout the whole of the day, not just when we sit in meditation. This is really fundamental. It's so obvious, but we can so easily overlook it. And then we make our meditation practice something which we do in isolation with the understanding or the wrong expectation that we can start to control our mind and get the result we want just by willpower. And so very often people will say, I can sit and I can force my mind to be quiet for a minute or two, but I can't keep it quiet, so what am I doing wrong? The idea that we are in control of our mind and we can force it to be what we want, this is a basic wrong understanding of the nature of the mind. The Buddha's path is to work with the mind in every moment of our day. And so it matters how we use our speech and our behaviour, because that arises out of our mind. And if we want to start to get to know our mind, meditation is the way that we do it, when we come directly in contact with our mind. And if you only sit for one meditation session, it becomes very obvious to you that you're not in control of your mind. Even with willpower, you can't stop the thinking. You can't keep the mind where you want it to be, on the breath or any other object that you choose. If someone else tells you that, you don't believe, because you have the idea that I'm in control of my thinking, and thinking is me. I think what I like. What comes into my mind is what I choose to think. But one session of meditation shows you that that's not the case. Now, when we start to meditate, and particularly in this kind of situation where there's some guidance, why is it that we take so long to actually get to the breath? Why is it that we take so long looking at the body, trying to relax the body, trying to feel the body, where we have our hands, to feel the touch of the air? It's because the ordinary mind, the untrained mind, is so used to being active and busy. It has a momentum of its own. It just keeps moving on from one thing to the next. And when you sit to meditate and you try to forcibly stop the mind from moving, you just get into a battle, because there's so much wound up energy in the mind that you can't force it to stop. And so you give the mind something to pay attention to, which is a little bit interesting, a little bit gross, not so fine and subtle as the breath. So you can feel the temperature, it's hot or it's cold. You can feel the touch of the air. You can hear the sounds around you. They're easy to pick up. They're not outside our normal experience. But the other characteristic about them is that they are happening in the present moment, right now. And this is where we want to be able to focus our awareness. Until we start to meditate, we don't realize that most of the time we aren't even in the present moment with what we're doing at this time. The mind is caught up in thinking about the past and the future. Planning, dreaming, remembering, caught up in all things that aren't to do with what we're doing right now. And we'd also have this wrong understanding that thinking is all the mind does. That's the mind. The mind is thinking. But there's actually much more to the mind than just thinking. But for the untrained person with that narrow experience, when you say mind and you say me, it automatically comes up thinking. And thinking is not about the present moment. But the present moment is the only place where we can really wake up and see what's going on. And so that's why we give the mind something to do at the beginning of the meditation, to gradually encourage it to come into the present moment, be interested in what's happening, see what's happening, see the difference between something that's happening right now and a thought about something that happened this morning. The thought is happening in the present moment, and we can be aware of thinking as something that is happening in the present moment, but mostly we can't even separate our awareness from the thinking. We're caught up in the thoughts. We are that incident that happened earlier in the day. So thinking can be an object of our attention, but we first of all have to even become aware of the fact that it is possible to observe thinking as an object without just getting lost in the story that the thoughts contain. Now, the other reason why we take our time to pay attention to something that the mind might be interested in is because the mind has to have an object. There has to be something that is arising, that is happening in the mind at any moment. The mind cannot be a vacuum with no object. And so if we just try to use willpower to stop the thinking, to force out the thoughts that we don't like, and this is particularly in the case of people who have obsessive thoughts which take them into suffering, and they just try to get rid of those thoughts, the nature of the mind is that you can't just have nothing in the mind. You have to have something. And unless you realize this, you wage a fruitless battle, a losing battle, to stop those thoughts coming in. You have to replace them with something else. And if the mind is used to being very busy, and as most minds are, having been through a busy week, a busy day, having lots of things going on before you came here that you've got to do after you finish here, it's not possible just to shut out the thoughts and not put anything else there. So we put something in there that is a wholesome object that isn't going to stir up the mind too much. So that's why we pay attention to how the body feels. We're interested most of the time in our body. We like to take care of it. We want to make sure it's okay. We identify with it as who we are. So the body is one of those objects that we're interested in, but we may never have, through the course of the day, given it a moment's notice. But now we're giving it our attention, and we try to do it in a loving way. So we not only colour what we're looking at, but how we're looking at it, in a very kind and compassionate way. So when we realise that the body is tight or is aching, then we try to relax with loving kindness. We're looking on it in a very gentle and soft way, rather than making a problem of the fact that there's an ache or a pain there. So we're giving the mind something, an object to pay attention to, because it has to have an object. There has to be something in the mind. We can't just shut everything out. And once we have developed a mind that is not so busy, not so restless, a little more peaceful, a little more tranquil, then we take up an object like the breath, which is more refined, which is more subtle. It's not so juicy as the pain in our back, or not so juicy as the noise someone else is making next to us, so that we really get caught up in the idea of this person making a noise. We can pay attention to that, but it's not necessarily in a skillful way. So the breath is a very neutral object, and we put our attention on the breath to give the mind something to pay attention to, and something which is very soothing and which can take us into deeper levels of stillness and peacefulness. Now, as I mentioned in the meditation, the mind is focused on one place, one object. The mind remains still while the breath moves in and out. So the simile that's given is like the breath is like someone coming and going over the threshold of the house, coming inside and going outside. But you have a gatekeeper at the door who doesn't go in and doesn't go out, just is watching as people come in and go out. And this gatekeeper is the mind, the awareness, what we call mindfulness, established at the point where we feel the breath going in and going out. So the mind is still, the breath moves. And the more we can focus, rest, not with strain, not with tenseness, but with brightness, on that point where we feel the breath, more and more stillness, more and more peacefulness, pleasant feeling will arise in the mind. Now, meditation is a wonderful practice ground, a training ground for being able to take the mind into stillness and peacefulness, to put the mind on an object and to be able to keep the mind, keep the attention on the object that we choose, rather than having the mind run away, which is what the ordinary mind does. The ordinary mind just goes wherever it usually goes. And this is one of the things to understand. It is the habit of the mind to move, and we're changing the habit of the mind by keeping it still and focused. Now, where the mind goes to is not according to our choices. The mind follows its habit patterns. And this is another thing that you can't understand directly until you start to practice meditation. You start to observe where the mind goes when it runs off. And you will observe that it doesn't go where you want it to go, where you consciously choose for it to go. It just follows where it usually goes, its habit patterns. And particularly in the case of obsessive thinking, if it's going again and again to the same place that causes you suffering, even if it's suffering and you know it's suffering, the mind will still go back to those same places. So when we're trying to address this kind of thinking pattern, the first thing we do is to recognize that it's bringing us suffering. And when we are living our everyday life, we might think that it's someone else who's causing us suffering because we're not getting what we want, we're not getting what we're obsessing about. So again, it's really difficult to see that it's our mind that is causing us suffering, not the other person, until we start to practice meditation. And then we get first-hand experience of the fact that our mind is just running out of control. And that's where the suffering is, that we don't have a choice over where it's going, what it's doing. And that's the real cause of suffering. Because sometimes we're going to get what we want in the world, and many times we're not going to. And if we can't learn to be with that in a peaceful way, then we're going to continually be living in an unhappy way. And so coming to terms with the reality of our life is one part, but learning to control the mind, deal with the mind, work with the mind is a way of learning to cope with the ups and the downs of life. And not to get caught in to patterns of thinking which actually take us into suffering no matter what is happening. We might get what we want, but because we obsess about it so much, we end up destroying any chance of happiness with that thing that we've got. Not to say of the times when we don't get what we want. So these are some basics about the nature of the mind. And now I'd like to give you a simile to help you to understand how when we are trying to change any patterns in the mind, that we have to understand that we have to do both the refraining from doing the things which are harmful or unskillful, which are causing us suffering, but we also have to actively cultivate and develop what is good, what is wholesome, if we want to change the patterns in the mind which are causing us suffering. Meditation is one of those things which is good, which is wholesome. So when we're thinking about the good that we need to do, very often people will think, oh, they're talking about giving dana, being generous, or maybe talking about just keeping precepts, living a virtuous life. Those are certainly aspects of cultivating what is good, but practicing meditation itself is cultivating what is good, getting to understand the mind, getting to know where our suffering comes from, and starting to learn how to work with the mind to produce happiness for ourselves. And if we produce happiness for ourselves, happiness for others as well. So the simile that I'd like to give you is one which I've been using quite regularly lately for people to understand what they need to do to change the habit patterns in the mind and why it takes a little bit of patience before you might get the result that you want. And the simile is that if you think of the mind like an empty glass jar, and into that glass jar you put 50 blue marbles or 100 blue marbles, and into the jar you put 3 red marbles, 2 white marbles and 5 yellow marbles. Now the glass jar represents the mind, and the different coloured marbles, or if you like, jelly beans, so you can think of this, remember this more easily if you're a jelly bean person. The different coloured jelly beans represent thoughts, kinds of thoughts. Now, for someone who's obsessing about something, the blue thoughts are that obsessive thinking, that thought that comes up again and again in the mind. And the other colours, the yellow, the red, the white, the few other colours that are in this jar, are like the few other thoughts that you have during the course of a period of time. Now, obviously, when you are having to deal with something and put your attention on something, maybe when you're at work or maybe when you're doing something at home, it is possible that the thing that you're doing requires your attention and you concentrate on it, and that takes your whole attention for a while. But even in the midst of doing that one thing, you'll find that the obsessive thoughts, the very familiar thoughts, the blue ones, will keep coming into the mind. Now, why is this? If you think about the jar and you think about someone who closes their eyes and puts their hand into the jar to pull out a coloured jelly bean or a coloured marble, there are 100 blue ones in there. There are a few yellow ones, a couple of white ones, a couple of red ones. it's more likely that when you put your hand in the jar, you will pull out a blue jelly bean. And even if you pull out one after the other, you've still got, even if you pull out 10 in a row, you've still got 90 of those compared to 3 or 4 of the other colours. And even if you take out 50 of those blue balls, you are still going to have 50 relative to the others. And so when you put your hand in, it's more likely that you'll once in a while get a red ball, but it's still more likely that for a long time you'll be pulling out the blue ones. And this is what happens with trying to change the content of the thoughts when we realize that the thoughts that we've got, the patterns of our thinking, are actually causing us suffering. They're things which we don't want to indulge in anymore. We don't want to play with them. And particularly if we've started to practice meditation and we would like to change the things that are causing suffering and we think we know how to do it, we're going to watch the breath, we're going to keep our attention on the breath, and every time the mind wanders away, we're going to bring it back. Now, if you think of that jar and you think about all those blue marbles in the jar, and then you think about the mind with all those thoughts in there, the obsessive thoughts, thoughts of a particular kind, it's only natural that when a thought arises in the mind at random, not one that you've deliberately brought into the mind, that it's going to be one of those nasty thoughts, the thoughts that cause suffering, thoughts to do with whatever it is you've been obsessing about. It's only natural that that's going to come up. And so you might decide, okay, yes, I know I've got to let go of the thinking and come back to the breath. And for the whole of the session, you keep having that thought come up and you keep letting it go as soon as it comes up and you come back to the breath. And at the end of the session, you think, well, where did that get me? I was still thinking those thoughts right to the end of the time I was sitting. So you might get very discouraged if you don't realize, well, of course, those thoughts are the ones that I've got most of. And they're the ones that are going to come up. They're more likely to come up again and again. So I just have to be very patient and keep working at taking out those unwanted thoughts. Because if I just recognize thinking something that's leads to unhappiness, and I don't fight with it, I don't play with it, I don't invite it in, I just let it go and come back to the breath, you're not feeding it. That one is gone. That one has passed away. But if you think about the jar, it's still got all those other balls, blue balls, left in it. Even if you get rid of 50, you've still got another 50, and there's still more of those blue balls than the other ones. And so it's going to be a while before you pull out another coloured ball. Unless, and this is the other part of the practice, and it takes a while to get this, and so it's useful if you just hold the image of that glass jar with the coloured balls in your mind and think, how could it be, even if I take out 50 and there's still 50 left, how could I change the likelihood that I'm going to get another coloured ball coming out when I put my hand in? The answer is that you've got to put more of the other coloured balls into the jar while you take out the ones that you don't want. It's so obvious. If you want to change the proportion, you have to put in more red ones, more yellow ones, more white ones. And that's why the Buddha said it's not enough just to refrain from doing what is harmful or unskillful. You have to actively cultivate what is wholesome and good. And this is the way that you purify the mind. Now, the simile that's given, which is very helpful again to realize how this purification takes place, is the image of the teaspoon of salt in the glass of water. If you put a teaspoon of salt in a glass of water, then the whole glass of water becomes undrinkable. But if you dilute that teaspoon of salt in a swimming pool of water, the taste is much less strong. And if you put that teaspoon of salt in a river, you don't even know it's there. And so as you dilute the salt, as you make it less the focus of whatever it is, the container that you've got, it's still there, but it no longer holds center stage. It's no longer the most powerful contact experience that you have. And that's why actively cultivating what is good is the indispensable other part of this path of practice. And if we try to just work with the mind, even when we start to understand the principles that we need to give the mind an object in meditation that it can rest with, that it can be happy with, that's tranquil, that's comforting, that we have to start to see the kind of thoughts that come in, that we don't choose them, they just come according to our habit patterns. Even if we start to understand all those things, if we don't support the mind by feeding the mind what is wholesome, what is good, what is skillful, then the balance in the mind will always stay on the side of what causes us suffering. It will always be on the side of the things that stir us up rather than the side of the things that calm us down. And it's only when the mind starts to become more tranquil and more peaceful that we can really start to see things clearly, to see our own habit patterns clearly, to see the connection between how we live our life and what happens to us in our life, how we live our life and what state of mind we're in, how if we cultivate the mind in meditation, it has a beneficial effect on how we live our life. We only really start to see those things clearly once the mind starts to calm down. So it's really important that we take up the whole of the path of practice. That is to abstain from, stop doing the things which hurt ourselves and hurt others, and then to stop doing that but also not to take it up again, and then to cultivate actively the things which are helpful and good. And then we have to be patient. We have to work at it. We have to persist with it. We can't expect to change the pattern of the mind overnight. And that's why, again, the wholesomeness is very important, because one of the qualities of wholesomeness is that it strengthens the mind. It gives the mind more stability. It makes it possible for us to bear with the pain, the discomfort, the unwanted things that will naturally come into our life, that will naturally come into our mind. So when those thoughts come, those obsessive thoughts, and they feel very uncomfortable, we don't want to follow them. When we cultivate goodness, when we make the mind stronger, we're able to resist them in the first place. We're able to bear with them until they pass away, so that they don't just bully us around and force us into acting, into doing things that we don't want to do, that we know are really not helpful for us. The actual experience of making the mind more and more peaceful, purifying it of anger and ill will, of greed, starting to understand ourselves better, the experience of that is that we have more inner peace, more inner happiness, more inner strength, more inner confidence, more self-respect, And all of these are qualities which help us to say no to the obsessive thinking, the addictive behaviour that's been pushing us around. We have this inner resource which we haven't had before. But we need to be patient and persistent in developing that, making it into a real strength, a real power in our life. If we think about becoming good at anything, any kind of skill, it takes time. Whether it's sports, music, learning a career, any of those things, we can't expect that we're going to master it overnight. We can't expect that we're going to be good at it straight away. And meditation is no different. Meditation is a skill which has to be practiced. It has to be practiced again and again. And as we practice, we learn from it. We learn what works for us, what helps us, how we can support the mind not to go into the kinds of thinking that lead us into suffering. So one of the consequences of doing what is good is that we become able to see the goodness in ourselves more easily. Someone was just talking about this to me recently. They were saying that they went shopping and they bought themselves a t-shirt, and they had a very nice time talking to the people in the shop. And when they went home, they realised that they'd left the t-shirt in the shop. They'd forgotten it. And they said their habit pattern in the past, which immediately came up, was to say, "You idiot, fancy leaving the t-shirt. How could you do such a stupid thing?" And then they heard themselves. Ah, that's the old pattern, critical mind. Putting yourself down, making it a big issue. This is the old pattern which leads to unhappiness and suffering. And then they realised what they were doing, and they immediately said to themselves, "Listen, you've been shopping for the last few weeks, all sorts of things, and not one time did you forget anything. Did you leave it in the shop? Did you forget to pick up what you had to pick up? So give yourself a break." And just to be able to do that, first of all, to be aware, to pick up the old pattern coming back, a pattern which has got a big stockpile still in the mind, even though there's been lots of work to recognise it and to counteract it. But it's still there, that stockpile, so it comes up when the conditions are right. And it plays itself out, the thought, and then the feeling, and then the story. Ah, but then the recognition, to just hold all of that and not to get swept away by it. When we feel we've done something stupid again, ah, not only does it make us feel like we're an idiot, but maybe we go and eat something or go and do something that takes away the pain that we don't like to feel because we've realised we're an idiot again. In our practice, when that unpleasant feeling comes up with that story, instead of going and reaching for something to eat or to drink or to do something else to take away that unpleasant feeling, we not only hear the story, but we feel the unpleasant feeling without it controlling us, without it ruling us, without us moving on to something that is going to be even more unskillful, take us further away from the happiness that we seek. And so as the person was telling me, they were saying, "Yes, I realised this was the old habit, and in that moment it felt very uncomfortable, and I could just hear the people who used to say those sort of things to me telling me again. But I just stayed with it. And then I was able to remind myself, I've been shopping lots of times in the last few weeks, and not once did I leave anything behind. So give yourself a break." And to counteract the unpleasant feeling, not to deny it, but just not to say that that unpleasant feeling is the absolute truth. And because it's so unpleasant, it's unbearable and I have to act on it to get rid of it. If we're able to stay with the unpleasant feeling, we'll notice that it just naturally stays for a while, gets less and less, passes away and ceases on its own. So the image that we have that's very helpful is of clouds passing through the sky. The sky is vast and empty, but the clouds pass through. And when they're in the sky, we may not think that there's any blue sky there, but once the clouds disappear, the blue sky's there again. So thoughts are like this, thinking is like this, feelings are like this. The feelings that come up and feel so terrible that we think we have to do something to get rid of them. If we can just learn to bear with them, develop the strength of mind, the strength of heart to bear with them, they will pass away. And if we don't act on them, if we don't fight them, if we don't feed them, then that's another one of those blue balls that has disappeared from our life. This is the way we practice. We practice the whole of the path. We're very fortunate because the Buddha has given us such clear guidelines in the Noble Eightfold Path. It contains all the ingredients that we need to learn to refrain from doing what is harmful to ourselves and others, to learn how to cultivate what is good and helpful, and how this leads to the purification of the mind. With the purification of the mind to a certain extent, we start to develop insight, wisdom, understanding about ourselves, then about the nature of the mind in general, and then about life on the biggest scale possible. And through understanding, through wisdom, we really become free of the habit patterns that drive us into suffering again and again. So I encourage all of you who are interested in cultivating happiness, finding peace, to understand and reflect on that we need to practice the whole of the path, not just refraining from the things that we know aren't good for us, but actively cultivating the things that are helpful. And if we can do that in our daily life, it will help us in our meditation. And the more we can do it in our meditation, the more it will become obvious to us how this carries over into our daily life. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Right. The question is, can you grow the seed of goodness or happiness from remembering good times, or do you have to do something in the present to make you're actually actively doing something in the present? Is that the question, basically?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So remembering good times is one of the ways where we do grow in strength of mind. And remembering that what I said, that the mind has to have an object. It can't be a vacuum. So if we have nothing in the present which is good that we've done or that is making us feel happy, the mind is going to latch onto something. And if our habit pattern is always in those times to go to something that's miserable, we have to start to replace those miserable habits with something that is more beneficial. And so one of the things we can do if we've got nothing happening in the moment is to revisit something that we've done. And actually the Buddha encourages us to make much of our virtue, make much of our goodness, and to make much of those times when we can look back and say, yes, I did something well, that was great. I did help this person, or I was kind, or I didn't get so angry. The Buddha encourages us definitely to go back and look at those things. And one of the ways in which we start to generate loving kindness for ourselves is to, if we feel at the moment that nobody loves us, that there's no person that we can bring into our mind to think about that person has loving kindness for us, is to go back and think of the people who've loved us in the past who may no longer be in our life. So we might go back to a school teacher we had when we were in primary school, or we might go back to a neighbour we had when we were a child, or a friend that we had at school, or someone who loved us who's no longer in our family. So revisiting those positives is one of the ways we can skillfully use the past to help us to build up the strength of the mind in the present. Because it's much more skillful to do that than to allow the mind to take up an object of misery and to stay with that object, because there's nothing else to put in the mind. Yes. Yes. Is there something that's cultivated through this practice that is more peaceful than and more joyful that within the mind and its objects? Yes. And that's what we cultivate. And as we cultivate it, we uncover the joy. We uncover greater joy and happiness within the mind, which is there independent of whatever object we are engaged with at the moment. So until we become developed in the practice, the joy and happiness that comes from meditation is always impermanent. It has the nature to arise and pass away like everything else that is conditioned. But when we have developed the joy and happiness that comes from insight, from truly understanding life, then that joy and happiness is a constant companion. But that's once the mind has started to unfold, if you like, to its true nature, rather than what most of us know, and that is the mind in relation to objects, sense objects, objects that we can see or taste or touch or smell or come in contact with through feeling. Most of us practice within the world of sensuality, sense contacts, and that's the world we know as a source of happiness. But beyond that world, there is a deeper source of happiness from within the mind itself, which can be accessed through meditation, but which only becomes permanent once our insight, true understanding arises. That's the nature of the mind, is happiness. So the question is, If we have a friend or a relative who we can see becoming obsessed with something, more immersed in that, how can we help them to overcome that and see that there's more to life than that? It can be helpful if you understand from your own experience the nature of the mind and can speak to them in a way that helps them to realize that this is the nature of the mind, that what we put into it habitually, repeatedly, is what will arise in the mind more often, more easily, and that's how obsessive patterns get established. But there is actually an aspect of the mind which can start to know that. So we're looking at the wisdom aspect. The other part is that if people are getting into a very negative rut, then sometimes if we're close enough to them, we can help to expose them to other experiences, more positive experiences, which actually give the opportunity to fill the mind with something else other than the thing that they're obsessed with. So encouraging people who are depressed, for example, to do acts of service, to go and cultivate kindness and concern for others, to look for ways in which you can include people in activities that will have a beneficial and positive effect on the mind. So sometimes you have to be very active in exposing those people to an alternative experience. And then they will probably say, oh yeah, I felt good while I was doing that, but then as soon as I stopped, I was back in the same rut. And you say, yes, that's the nature of the mind. So instead of being dismayed at what's happening in their mind, you start, if you understand your own mind, start to show them, yes, this is the way the mind operates. So if you want it to change tack, if you want to replace those habits, you have to feed the mind something else. Whatever you feed the mind is what will produce the mind. If you want the mind to have a different colour, you've got to feed it a different colour. So as a friend, sometimes you actively try to encourage that person and do things with them that will actually feed the mind something else.